All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Tuckians? What the fuckinistas? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Welcome to it. Nice to have you. How are you? Let's just talk about you for a second. What's happening? Everything okay? Uh-huh. Oh, really? Well, that's good. Oh, it's not good. Sorry, I misunderstood the tone. Oh, Jesus. Yeah, that's bad. I don't know how I... Yeah, I'm an idiot. No, I'm sorry for not being more sensitive. I don't know you that well, and you sound excited, but now I know that you're really upset. Yeah, well, I'm sorry. Oh, but it's better. Oh, okay, so that's better. Yeah, good. Well, that's good. It's nice that you have a few things in your life that, you know, you can at least fall back on as being okay and not just that one thing. But that'll get better, right? Oh, you don't know. Well, maybe it will. Hopefully it will, right? Uh-huh. Okay, well, we'll see what happens. But yeah, I mean, I would just, keep doing what you're doing, right? And if it's not hurting you, you know, only you can know. Anyway, I hope that conversation was enjoyable for you. I enjoyed my side. What's going on? This is the first day back in the garage. That's right. I talked about rewatching The Sopranos, which I'm still doing, and it seems like a lot of people are doing it. That's the weirdest thing about serendipity or coincidence or things that are beyond coincidence. Somebody told me that Stern had talked about rewatching it, and then other people were emailing me, and they're like, well, I just started watching it too. I mean, I don't know what's in the air, what's compelling those of us who share that impulse to go watch The Sopranos again. Maybe it's some type of stability. Maybe there was a time where every Sunday we would look forward to that thing, and it gave us stability, knowing that we would be jarred and excited to watch The Sopranos. I don't know, but I can't stop watching them. I'm happy I am. Though it has triggered some things. It's triggered some things. What can I tell you? Today on the show, Chris Garcia is here. He's a comedian. He's opened for me before. I enjoy his comedy. He's very funny. He's got a new album coming out called Laughing and Crying at the Same Time. Actually, it's available. I'm just getting this in. Just in that it's now available, but it's going to come out on vinyl on the 30th, on root beer colored vinyl. So he'll be here soon. I would like to mention an old friend of the show, an old buddy of mine, Mike Doty, has a new album coming out called The Heart Watches While the Brain Burns, which is apparently a quote I said on this show while trying to kick nicotine gum. Happy to help out, Mike. I'm glad you got a record coming out. It comes out October 14th, and the first video for the single, I Can't Believe I Found You in That Town, premieres today. Today, if you want to watch Mike Doty's video on the music website Brooklyn Vegan, head over to brooklynvegan.com to check it out and pre-order Mike's album wherever you get music. Passionate guy, that Doty. You might know him from the old days in Soul Coughing, but he's a worker, intense shit, good songwriter, good singer, good guitar player. All the shit is good there, right? All my tour dates are up. All the ones that have been rescheduled are now up at WTFpod.com. The Wilbur coming up quickly next weekend, September 24th. I don't know. I believe there's some tickets for that late show. Campbell Hall at UCSB in Santa Barbara, October 21st. Go grab them. Largo here in LA, October 22nd. Yeah, I think there are tickets. The Ice House, October 23rd in Pasadena. Yup. Carnegie Hall. They're going. Few tickets left. I would do that if you're going to do that. November 19th at the James K. Polk Theater in Nashville, Tennessee. The Vic Theater in Chicago, December 3rd. So what's been going on since I last talked to you? Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. That's what's been going on. I went over, did a wardrobe fitting, did some pictures, did some camera tests for the shoot for the show Glow for Netflix. Had to shave off a little bit of my shit. So now I look like a stranger in the mirror, but that's good. I need to look like a stranger to myself to become the stranger that I will become that has some similar things that I do. Very exciting. Saw Alison Brie, met a lot of the other people, the other actors. Going to be exciting. I went to the set. I saw the set. It's very exciting. All of it's very exciting. I read the first two scripts. I'm thrilled. And then last night just spiraled. Just fucking went right down the goddamn self toilet. unbelievable. I had forgotten what it felt like to just fall without a net into the never-ending pit of insecurity. Can I do this? Did they pick the right guy? Oh, no. And then, hey, why don't we look up some psychiatric diagnoses to see maybe you're even worse than you thought. Why don't you beat the shit out of yourself for a few minutes about what you ate when you were away? Why don't you do a little of that? Why don't you do it all at once? Have the initial bit of insecurity as opposed to excitement for the new job. Why not go the other way? Why not, instead of going like, this is going to be great, looks fun, everybody's excited, I'm excited. No, let's go like, I can't do it. I'm not the guy. I'm not good at anything. Jesus, what am I even fucking thinking? Why am I even a comedian? Why do I do a podcast? Acting, that's ridiculous. Who am I really? Man, just plummeting down the beautiful pit of self into the pure damp darkness. What got me out of it? I don't know. I pulled it together. I realized like, hey, this is a symptom. It's an old fucking symptom of my brain. I'm excited. I'm going to do a great job. The character is good for me. And I don't have any major psychological problems, but I do underestimate how emotionally fucked up I am. I like to play that down by not thinking about it. That's one way to handle psychological problems. Hey, you know, I got these problems. Let's not deal with them and not think about it. What do you think of that idea? Sounds good to me. You sure you don't want to take another flight down the pit? Nah, let's watch The Sopranos. Good idea. So my dad, right? He was up there. I told you he was in Rochester. And look, you know, I've let a lot of stuff go. I understand who he is. I know what the deal is. But when I'm freaking out, It all leads up to it. You know, I spent, you know, 2 days hanging out with him on and off, and that just kind of fucks the wiring up a little bit. He is who he is. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm pretty happy with where I'm at in my life, and I was sharing that with him about all the things I'm doing and the new show, and he was like, you know, he said he was proud of me, and then after this big, long conversation, you know, about maybe a half hour later in the car, he goes, you know that, what's that kid's name? The Facebook guy, Zuckerberg? Yeah, how do you do that? How do you come up with something like that? And in my mind, like, it didn't feel like an innocent question. It felt like a giant eraser. It just felt like, you're not that guy. He figured it out. You're doing a lot of stuff, but that's Zuckerberg, right? And then he talked about, you know, winning the lottery, that kind of stuff. But I tried to just stay in my own shit, stay detached from his shit, and enjoy my little old dad. He's becoming a little old dad, having some trouble with the stairs, that kind of stuff. There's no joy in my heart. There's no glee in my tone. But life will humble you. And then I got this email. The dad stuff always gets me. You know? This just subject line, thank you. Dear Mark, I just wanted to take a second to write and compliment you on the recent interview you did with Billy Crystal. I had the pleasure of listening to this talk while driving from Chicago to Michigan, where I was going to hook up with some family for a small vacation. At one point in the trip, we were all in my father's car on yet another long drive across the peninsula when my dad asked me if I had anything good to listen to. I told him about your recent conversation, and since he too is a big Billy Crystal fan, he told me to put it on. At first, I couldn't tell if he liked it. My dad will give a pilot quiet to things he doesn't really enjoy, and for the first few minutes, he seemed to be doing just that. And now you think right here he could insert, but I fast-forwarded through the intro. But no, he said, but then Billy started talking about the draft lottery and how he was so lucky to get a high number. My dad started reminiscing almost immediately about his experience during that very night, an experience he had never spoken of before. He told me how he was 18, a freshman at Penn State, watching terrified with all the other guys in their common room. Most of them, including my father, were not called till late, but he went on to say that his friend from childhood had his number called in the first 100, and just a year or so after that lottery, his friend was killed in Vietnam. Needless to say, your conversation was very thought-provoking, and it enabled my dad to tell us about a part in his life that I, and even my mother and my aunt, who were also in the car, had no idea about. It was a very moving moment, and I feel that it brought me closer with my father. So for that, I say thank you. Keep up the great work. I love listening to the podcast, and I hope to see you the next time you're in Chicago. Boomer Lives, Chris. That, I'll tell you, man, that makes this the best job in the world. It really does. It's great to hear that, you know, if something that we put out there and that conversation provokes other conversation, I just, beautiful. Got a little choked up when I read that the first time, Chris. Thanks for sending it. Now, another Chris is on my show right now. Chris Garcia, very funny comedian who talks about his father as well a lot in a very touching way. His album, comedy album Laughing and Crying at the Same Time, is now available, and it's going to be out in root beer colored vinyl on September 30th. That'll include a digital download with a bonus track. You can also go to ChrisGarciaComedy.com for his tour dates. This is me and the lovely Chris Garcia. I think that the first time I met you was at Rooster Teeth Feathers.
Yeah.
You were featuring for me or doing guest spots. Was that the week I was there with Siroff?
No. It was you, me, and Sam Morrell.
Right. Who was that guy? He was like an East Coast guy.
He's a New York guy. He's great.
Yeah. Is he around?
Yeah, he's around. He's doing super well.
He is? What's he doing?
I don't know. He's always like, he's like a Comedy Central guy. He headlines around.
Uh-huh.
He's on TV and stuff, and he's really funny. He's like, he's like one of the New York guys that are kicking butt.
But that was the first time I met you. You were there. I thought you were odd. You had a weird energy. You seemed sweaty to me. You had a guitar, and you used that. But I thought it was funny. I thought it was very funny.
Oh,
I enjoyed
you.
Your act, but I couldn't get a handle on you. I thought you were you were just an odd sort.
Oh, that's...
You were kind of like, I didn't know if you were gay or weird or... You know, like you didn't know how to talk.
Really? You thought I was that? Oh, that's great. I put that off. I remember you being grumpy, and you were pacing around, and you'd stop every once in a while. You'd be like, "You a San Francisco guy?" And I'd be like, "Yeah." You go, "Oh, okay." And then you'd walk away, and then you'd come back, and you're like, "You gonna play guitar?" I'm like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Hmm. All right." And then you're like, have fun. He was like, you told Sam, he's like, you're going to go out there and do your New York shit. And Garcia, you're going to go out there and do your sweet, sensitive Latino thing, I guess.
Yeah.
I
was right.
I thought it was, I interpreted that as a compliment.
I sound like I nailed it.
Yeah, you did good.
Was that the week where I was all mad about the sound system?
Yep, you were very mad about the sound system.
Oh, and I forced them to change it, and they tried to adjust it, and it sucked more.
Yeah.
But I heard that they went out and got a whole new system since then.
Yeah, because of you.
They did?
Yeah, they did. I think the very next day, they got a new system.
Does it sound better? Have you been up there?
Yeah. I don't remember the sound quality being that bad to begin with, but it sounded good.
It was bad.
Yeah.
So, what is the story now? Now, you just auditioned for SNL, because I know I got a text from you.
Okay.
What happened with that?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything yet. But yeah, they flew me out there.
What was the process? How did it happen?
Well, they asked my manager for me to submit a tape of characters.
Do you have characters?
Yeah, I do characters and stuff.
You do?
Yeah.
Like what?
Me and Singer do that show, Underbelly, where we do characters and stuff.
So you have a bunch you've invented?
Yeah, a bunch of characters.
What are their names?
There's Manny.
Yeah.
Manny, he's from Ecuador. His father's a toucan and his mother's a witch. Uh-huh. He's just like an odd little guy. And I do a bunch of different characters.
Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah.
You do impressions?
Not really. I did Pablo Escobar reviewing Narcos, the TV show, and that was fun. But I'm not really an impression guy.
So they flew you out.
They flew me out.
Yeah.
And since the tape, I was like, I have no chance of getting this. I'm just going to have fun.
Right.
I wasn't even going to do it because I was like, I'm leaving for Cuba on like my honeymoon tomorrow.
Yeah.
I don't have time for this. And I was like, oh, I'll just put it together. And they liked it. And then they brought me in to audition at UCB. And I was like, I have no chance.
Right.
And, you know, people were like, other people backstage doing push-ups and shit, and all hyped.
Really? There was that going on?
There was that, and I was like, I got no shit. I'm not even a UCB guy.
People doing warm-up exercises in the dressing room?
Singing and stuff.
Really?
And yeah, people were getting really getting their game. This is a lot of people's dreams, and they were really psyched. And I just was like, I have no chance. I'm going to have fun. And then
comedians.
I had fun. And they called me and said they wanted me to fly out and go for it. And, you know, you did it.
I didn't, yeah, but it was different. Not really, but so you did it. You went to the studio.
I went to the studio. I tried not to get psyched up about it and just have fun. But right. Like, I was like, oh, my, they put, you know, you put you up right across from 30 Rock and all this stuff. And I was, you know, I just got a little, I started getting like pumped up.
Right.
Like it was a big thing. So I went for a run in the rain. I was like, I got to run. And I started thinking about, I was trying to find mental leverage, and I was in, like, just running through the rain, Rocky style, and I was thinking about, I was like, my dad was a fucking political prisoner for 2 years in Cuba, and my family lives there. I'm not scared of this Canadian fuck. Like, this motherfucker cannot scare me. This is nothing. This is a privilege. And then I ran through the rain, and the first thing I see in Central Park is Jose Martí. It's like the statue of, like, the Cuban. He's like the Cuban Abraham Lincoln.
Right,
he's like
right.
the national hero.
Right.
And I see it as a sign.
Oh, yeah,
I start
it's all going
crying and shit. And I'm like, I run up to the statue, and I, like, put my hand on it. I'm like, ah. Oh. And at that time, I was like, I'm not playing it cool anymore. Like, I am not having
crying
fun.
In front of the statue.
Yeah. I just got so pumped. And
touching the statue for good luck because you thought that all things were moving your way.
Yeah.
That cannot be a coincidence.
Yeah.
That I end up in front of this statue of Jose, what's his name?
Martí. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I went in and, you know, tried to have fun, and it was all right.
Yeah, how'd you do in the room?
It was good.
Yeah?
Yeah, they, you know, they try not to laugh and stuff.
Yeah.
But I got some chuckles, and it's intense.
Yeah.
They make you wait for a little while.
You saw Lauren sitting there?
Saw Lauren and the crew. I think he was there. Like, it's just a blur. Like, people are just, like, 30 feet away, and
right.
these little rafters, and they have their little note
right.
books and stuff.
Horrendous.
And so, I don't know. It's not in my hands. I had fun.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be cool if I got it. Maybe one day I'll tell my kids that I got to audition for it.
You're already planning that story?
I'm already planning that story.
You can do the rough version of what you just did for me now?
Yeah.
That, like, all the signs were there, but he let you down. Jose, what's his name?
Jose Martí.
Jose Martí let you down.
Yeah.
You disappointed the entire country of Cuba.
And my family, everybody. I could have been another national hero.
Yeah. Yeah. There could have been the Chris Garcia statue.
First Cuban on SNL.
Would you have been?
I think so. I think there's only been like Horatio Chilean, I think.
Is he Chilean? Yeah.
And Fred's Venezuelan.
Right. Half Venezuelan. Right. So you would be representing Cuba. This would be a good move politically, I think.
I think I could make the change.
Yeah.
I could be, you know.
It'd be a good thing for Cuba if you got SNL.
Oh, it would be huge for
both. A victory.
I could be like Rocky in Rocky IV.
You would be the wall coming down.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be great.
I don't know if that would be that way. So, but where were you born, dude?
I was born here in LA in Inglewood.
Really?
Yeah.
And both your parents are Cuban?
Both my parents are from Cuba.
How many siblings you got?
I got an older sister. She was born in Cuba.
Really?
Yeah, so I'm the first one in my family born here. And yeah, my sister's older than I am because my parents, they just didn't have a kid for a while in Cuba, like right after they had her, things got tough, and then they moved to Spain, and they always thought about moving to the United States, so they held off.
Was Spain easier? Is that an easier move? I mean, why Spain?
Well, yeah, it was an easier move to go into a big, yeah. My dad is an exile, and he was pretty much kicked out of Cuba, so that's where he went.
During the revolution, that can't go that far back. How... Right? He wasn't...
No, my dad...
Not in the mid-60s or...
No, it was like the late 60s. And...
Yeah.
Here,
move that down a little.
Here we go.
And bring
late
it back
60s.
In. There you go.
But I actually just learned a lot of his backstory that I was not ever really kind of told by my family.
Because you just went to Cuba.
Because I just went there.
Well, I want to get to that. But I... okay, we can fill in the backstory. What was the story that you got as a kid? So you're growing up in Inglewood.
Yeah.
Wait, how'd you end up in the Bay Area? Are they still here?
Yeah, my parents are in L.A.
Okay, so you moved to, so that was your own move.
Yeah, yeah. I lived in Inglewood and then Westchester for a couple years.
Westchester, New York?
Westchester, L.A., okay. Just right next to LAX. That's okay. Where I grew up.
Oof.
And then my parents, they lost their house, and so they moved to North Redondo, so, like to a apartment in North Redondo so I can go to a school in Manhattan Beach for high school.
But so you had the beach. Redondo's a nice beach.
Yeah, it was nice. My parents... they moved to North Redondo so I can go to school in Manhattan, a school called MiraCosta.
Uh-huh.
And since my dad was out of a job, he was in the adult ESL program.
What's ESL?
English as a second language.
Uh-huh.
So my dad was in the bungalow across from my classroom. And so my dad went to school at the same time as me for my first year at that school.
Was that embarrassing or nice?
That was pretty embarrassing.
Oh, really?
Because he was just always there. I was in...
Did you eat lunch with him?
I did not eat lunch with him. He tried.
Oh, you iced your dad?
I was a teenager.
Wow.
Yeah, I did not eat lunch. I tried to avoid it. And
so other kids are like, is that your dad? And you're like, yeah, but it's all right. You just saw him eating by himself?
Pretty much. I don't know what he did for lunch, but I was just in those bungalows for homeroom, like second period. And then after that, I was just off to my other classes.
You're out.
Yeah, I was out. But I would see him every morning.
You didn't go to school together?
Yep.
He took you to school.
He'd yell at me and stuff and embarrass me. And he'd try to get super involved, like with baseball. He got super involved. And because, it's like a Cuban pastime. And I didn't make my sophomore year, I didn't make JV. I made frosh soph.
Yeah.
And my dad was so pissed off about it. And he straight up was like, you didn't make it because you jerk off too much. He was like, you masturbate too much. And he's like, you got nothing left in the tank. And
left in the tank.
And he totally called me on it. And it was kind of true. Like, I was just like jerking off too much.
How did he know? They know, huh?
Yeah. Small apartment.
Yeah. And he was waiting. He was waiting to turn that on you.
Yeah.
Oh, did you do that in front of people?
No.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that's good.
Declare it in front of my biology teacher.
Well, what was his job? Like, what did you know about him in terms of what was the family mythology of why he had to leave Cuba?
The mythology was that it was really tough for him for being not communist.
Uh-huh.
And he was sent away to work in some fields.
Yeah.
And then because he wasn't communist and he was separated from my mom and my sister, who was like a year or two old.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, he was kicked out of the country and he like moved to Spain.
That was the story. And what was his occupation when you were younger?
A machinist. So he worked like at aerospace jobs and stuff like that. And even though I think it was frustrating for him because he was really smart and kind of like an engineer type, but
yeah,
he came to America as like 37, like his mid-late 30s.
Right.
And so he just got factory jobs as a machinist and just worked as a machinist the rest of his life.
But by the time you started high school, he'd been out of work and he couldn't really speak English or what?
Yeah, his English wasn't strong. Like he came in his mid-30s and he just hit the ground running and just started working immediately. So he spoke with broken English and was always trying to figure out a way to... Like, he's very ambitious.
Yeah.
And he put a lot of that into me just to focus on me to have a better life.
Yeah.
But he was always trying to hustle, get a better job and stuff like that. So while he had unemployment or whatever, he's like, I'm going to try to improve my English to get a better job.
Uh-huh. And your mom did what?
My mom was a electronic assembler. Like she
really?
A factory worker where she'd do whatever. Like she was a person, if you see like a keyboard that says like inspected by number 35. Like,
oh yeah.
That was my mom.
She was number 35?
My mom was number 35. And she did that pretty much her whole career. They were both factory, like blue collar.
Wow. Did your dad work over at LAX at all?
No, he didn't work at LAX, but he worked at like those aerospace companies over there, like McDonnell Douglas,
oh, really?
And Northrop and Rockwell and JPL. Like he bounced from place to place.
Uh-huh.
And as the economy got worse in the 90s, a lot of those jobs went to like overseas.
Yeah.
And so jobs like more manual stuff, like machinists, those jobs
they
started
got
disappearing
pushed
or
out.
Started going like in other
right.
being made by robots and
right.
stuff. So he had a very skilled trade that
in
just
specific,
started disappearing.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you were like younger, was baseball the thing you wanted to do, or were you just doing that?
Oh, I loved baseball. Like, yeah? It was
the, what position were you?
Pitcher, first base, and right field. All the left-handed stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't very athletic, but my dad is a badass, and he, at a young age, I already knew how to like bunt and throw a curveball. And
he's
like,
a big baseball guy.
Big baseball guy.
Who was your team?
I'm a Dodger guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I grew up with the Dodgers. Like, hometown kid.
Yeah.
I just grew up
with... Did you go over to watch the games?
I would go to the games when I was a kid and watch Fernando and, like, Steve Sachs, all the, like, the 80s.
Yeah. So, all right. So you're going to baseball games. You're an L.A. kid. Are you, like, do you have friends? Do you have a car? Are you going into Hollywood? Or when do you start getting interested in, you know, fucking your life up with show business?
As a little kid.
Yeah?
Just, like, being a latchkey kid. And
how much older is your sister?
12 years.
Oh my God. Do you know her?
I know her pretty good. Not like someone that's my age, but we've gotten closer and closer. But by the time I was 8, she was out of the house.
Right.
She was married already.
Wow. Still married?
Still married.
That's good.
Yeah.
Nieces and nephews?
I got nieces and nephews and everything.
Oh, you're like a regular guy.
A regular dude.
Yeah, maybe that's what I was sensing when we were working together.
Like, what's wrong with this
guy? Yeah, what's wrong with this dude? Looks like he had a pretty good family.
Yeah.
So when you were young, you started moving towards?
Yeah, I was just like class clown. Like I was always, even at, when I was in a Latin school, I stuck out because I was light skinned. Or when I transferred to other schools, I had a funny lunch, you know, or my parents spoke funny.
Yeah.
And we had a shitty car. So it was always kind of an outsider.
Car? Yeah, what kind of car?
My parents had a Gremlin. They had a Nova. They've had like a bunch of old, now cars that would be kind of cool.
Novas are pretty cool. People hot rod those things.
Yeah. So that type of, you know, American car.
Yeah. Good American car. The Gremlin was an odd car.
A Dodge Dart.
Oh, yeah. Those were pretty, the people like those, too.
Yeah.
Because you make them go fast, too, I think, right?
Yeah, you can make those go fast.
The Nova is what people love, or am I thinking of, Chevy Nova, you could turn those out, right?
Yeah, those are badass. Yeah.
So, all right, so you're that kid.
I'm just the kid that's, you know, I'm hanging out, and all my other, like, I went to a Catholic school in Westchester when I grew up in Englewood, which is, Westchester's a little, at the time, was like a better neighborhood, and my parents didn't want me to go to school in LA, USD.
Mm-hmm.
Anymore. And so I went to a school in Westchester and all this like immigrant kids were just like, it was the kids that had mustaches in fifth grade are hanging out like the, you know, me and the Palestinian kid and the Lebanese kid and the Italian kid and the Filipino kid.
The Russian kid.
There was a Russian kid and it was just us and our little UN that we had in the corner. And it was, you know, it was the same kids for like a long time, same 30 kids in the same school. But it was mostly like...
So you're always like isolated with those kids?
No, I mean, they ended up being okay, but I found out that my way to assimilate and become friends with people is to be the funny kid.
Right.
And so I looked back, I was at my mom's house looking through storage the other day and I found a yearbook from when I was like in second grade and it was signed by Sister Perpetua, like the nun that said, to Chris, the comedian.
Oh,
like,
really?
And I was just like always either because I was...
That was a nice way of saying you were a pain in the ass.
Yeah. A very nice Irish Catholic way to say that I was a pain in the ass. But I think because also I spent a lot of time at home by myself when my parents were at work, I was just watching... You know, The Cosby Show and just watching, like,
and all that
I
after,
love Steve Martin and all that stuff.
Were you watching those afternoon talk shows or was that before your time?
I watched some of those, but it wasn't really super
but they weren't featuring comedians then. Like, there was that gap. Like, you're probably too young for, like, Merv Griffin and Mike Douglas and all that shit that I saw when I was a kid.
Yeah. I guess there was Jenny Jones. I think she was a comedian.
She was a comedian. Yeah. I think she was from Seattle. I don't know what happened to her.
I don't know.
She was kind of a comedian.
Yeah.
I'd always see her pictures at comedy clubs. I never saw her perform or anything.
Yeah.
And she did a talk show, though, like Phil Donahue style.
Yeah, on, like, channel, not one of the major networks. She was, like, channel 13 or 11 or something.
How's your Cuban?
My Cuban?
Yeah.
My Spanish?
Yeah.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's...
All intact?
All intact.
Is that straight up Spanish or is it Cuban Spanish? So I'm not being condescending.
No, that's fine. Cuban Spanish is a little different. It's faster. It's very loud.
Yeah.
It is a very loud Spanish. A lot of slang.
Yeah.
And you only pronounce like half the word. And so sometimes... So when I was there at first, it took a little getting used to. I was like, okay, I have to really turn it up. And by the end, it was fine. But at the beginning, I was like, hola, ¿cómo estás? Yeah, yeah. And by the end, I was like, oye, tipo, ¿cómo era, coño?
Oh, yeah?
Like,
yeah?
It was really...
Got the intonation going?
Really got the intonation, because I wanted to, because it was like, you know, I think...
Was it second nature, in a way? I mean, did you grow up with that, or were your parents sort of like trying to speak English?
My parents, I mean, I always spoke Spanish at home, and I still speak Spanish with my family, except for my sister.
Right.
And they're not super... kind of flamboyant, like, you know, like they're not, you know, like that. They're more mild mannered. My dad's like a hot blooded Cuban type of guy.
Yeah,
but he's not loud and obnoxious.
He's not out in the street playing dominoes.
He's not in the street.
Is that wrong?
Not
that there's that wrong?
No. That's cool. but he's like more. He's not like super Miami. You know, right. Miami's like more flashy and everyone. My dad's like, you know, he's an engineer type and stuff.
You have to understand, the only images I have of Cuba are like people smoking very large cigars and playing dominoes in the street.
Yeah,
does that happen there?
Yeah, people are smoking cigars. People are playing dominoes.
Yeah.
People are driving old cars.
Right, because I almost went. We were trying to plan a trip. I don't remember which woman it was with. but before, I guess it's now getting a little easier, but you know, when we were looking into it, you had to fly through Mexico, from Mexico City or somewhere.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was very vague about whether or not, about renting a car, about whether there was lights, about where you stay. Like, it was not... Like, as interested as I was to maybe go there before it opened up, it seemed like it wasn't going to be an easy trip in terms of getting there. And I'm not, you know, I can handle a lot, but it just sounded like, I don't know.
I've traveled with you.
Where did we go?
We went to, we just went around the Midwest and stuff. We went to Cleveland and Minneapolis and Chicago.
Yeah, you did all those shows with me.
It's not easy traveling, you know. There's always, it's a little complicated. No. With you, it's easy to travel.
Yeah.
In Cuba,
yeah.
It's like, it's not, things are never, there's a lot of bureaucracy.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of, like, almost like secrecy. Like, it's hard to get a straight answer from someone because it might affect somebody else, you know? So you're like, you ask someone like, hey, how much is a cab to, you know, in Malecón or something? They'll be like, I really don't know. And you're like, oh, you really do know. You just don't want to say the price because someone else might try to get a different price out of you. And then you're the person that snitched on what the right price is.
Really?
And so you got to ask like a bunch of people sometimes to be like, hey, how much is this? And they're like, I don't know. Somebody's like, oh, it could be 20. And you're like, it's not fucking 20. It's like 5.
So it sounds like a little bit of an aggravation.
It's just different.
It's not
aggravation. I was just like, it's just a little more complicated than it is here.
All right. So now you're like in high school, you're watching TV, you're doing this shit. How do you end up in the Bay Area? How do you end up committing to comedy? And when does that start? I mean, class clown business and...
I was class clown. I finished school at in Manhattan Beach, and then I went to community college for a couple of years, and then I went to Berkeley to finish off, the rest of my education.
So you really locked down, huh? You got community college, and you locked in. Your grades in high school are okay, or not good enough, or what?
Yeah, they were fine, but I just couldn't really afford, and I wanted to go kind of do a better school than I could have.
Right.
Because I think after a couple years, at first I felt a little lost in high school, and then I was like, oh, I can do this. I can. I did Model UN, and that was big on me.
With all your old friends that you came up with?
yeah. We just took over the world in these simulated debates, and I traveled a little when I did Model UN, and I went to Georgetown and Berkeley to do these debates, and I was like, oh, I can roll with these kids.
And be in front of people.
I could be in front of people.
Yeah.
Those early debates were like early stand-up, because I'd just be like the funny.
And you'd write it all out?
I'd write it all out and do little routines and like win debates. Like I was a good debater. And
I don't know anything about structured debate.
Yeah, I didn't really either.
But you make your point, they make their point, you answer back, they answer back, and then you talk.
You start a delegation, and you like figure out little ideas with other countries. Like,
that was the UN part.
That was
just debating.
Yeah,
right.
And you'd go up, and you'd have a position paper, and you'd read your statement and stuff like that. And
you never thought about getting into politics or service?
I did at that time, but that was just
little youngster stuff.
But so I was like, oh, I could. And then I remember I did a debate at Berkeley, and I was like, this is where I want to go.
What was it about Berkeley?
It was just cool. Like, it was, you know, my parents are very conservative Cubans, like a lot of Cubans are. And Berkeley is the opposite
right.
of that.
Conservative so, what? With like Catholic-y conservative?
Yeah, they're religious. They're just, you know, a lot of Cubans come from Cuba and they're like, you know, communism, socialism, no thank you.
Right.
I'll just be the opposite of that. So,
right, right.
They're don't good like, people, but that's right. how, you know, they're
so
more
conservative,
on the
like fiscally conservative, like
fiscally, you know,
real pro-capitalism.
Yeah,
like, you
my
know,
dad was just like Ronald Reagan all the way.
Make
like,
your own way.
Make,
yeah.
like, even, you know, this space industry and right. like that stuff kept yeah. my dad in business because he, you know,
right.
made parts that went in the space shuttle or were part of, like, you know,
yeah,
naval ships. And
yeah,
so, like, he worked in that, so he was like, he was USA all
and
the way.
And he felt that connection.
He
like,
felt
you know,
that...
when the shuttle went up, he was like,
oh, yeah.
yeah.
I remember when I was a little boy and the Challenger happened and it just, like, it was, like, really hard on him because he took so much pride in working in aerospace and stuff like that. And he would tell me when he was a kid in Cuba that he would like think about, like, he would stare at the stars and think about space.
Really?
And think about and know that, like, you
well, you know,
we
they find out
there.
Now that the guy, you know, someone tried to rally against that. One of the engineers knew that the seals wouldn't hold at a certain temperature. It was really only.
Oh, crazy.
Oh, dude, the guy, I think he might have just died, but it was a burden on him his whole life. He tried to argue, he knew that the seals, like, they couldn't take off in the temperature they were taking off in because the seals would not tolerate it.
No.
And he told them that, and then he was voted down.
Yeah.
And they fucking just winged it and blew those people up.
Yeah. That's
it was
crazy.
One of those stories. And he lived with the burden of not being able to convince.
Wow.
Like, he stood his ground, but it was not enough to make them not send it off.
Oh, that's nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard it on NPR.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't your dad's fault is what
oh,
I'm saying.
No, thank you.
Yeah. It had nothing to do with whatever parts he made.
It'd be great if it was.
It'd be horrible.
This is what I'm here to talk to you about, Mark.
Oh, no.
No.
Going to break big news. So you're up at Berkeley at the hippie school.
I'm at the hippie school.
Hippie Ivy League school, right?
Ah, no, well, for
is
a
it?
No, it's not Ivy League,
oh,
but
it's
a, you
good
know,
one.
Good school.
Yeah.
And so I went there. I was also like in love with a girl that went to school in Portland, like a high school sweetheart that went to school in Portland. So I was like, well, Berkeley's closer.
Were you going up there too?
Yeah, I would go up there and go back and forth. I got my heart broken. I started a bunch of shitty bands.
What'd you, oh, you play guitar in bands?
Yeah.
Really?
Played guitar and sang.
Really?
Yeah.
So that was like what I saw and what you still sing about. I haven't seen you with the guitar in a while.
Yeah.
The La Bamba joke. Is that on the record?
It's on the record.
Okay, with the guitar?
No guitar. No guitar.
Oh, really interesting.
Album.
It chose no guitar.
Yeah. You're like,
yeah. It was hard to let it go. Is that what happened?
No, it was like it was a phase that I went through because mm-hmm. I started stand up with no guitar and then I was like, oh, I'm going to just play guitar.
Try to integrate it.
Yeah.
Many a person has tried that.
Yeah.
Few keep it in.
Yeah.
Hard to transcend the reputation of the guitar act.
Yeah.
And don't so, want to have the...
I don't want to be the guitar... No one
yeah,
wants to be the
guitar guy.
But everyone's like, oh, well, I guess he's doing guitar
yeah,
now and
he's
then.
A guitar guy. Who's Chris Garcia? The guy with the guitar?
Oh,
yeah.
God.
He
nothing,
closes,
oh, God.
Closes with that guitar bit.
Oh. It was a phase. No, I had good jokes. I had good stuff that came
no,
out
No, I liked
there.
It. I liked it. So you were playing in like sensitive emo
oh,
punky
yeah.
bands?
A band called, called Love Minus Zero.
What?
Yeah, I know. So Dylan song, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it was very emotional.
Uh-huh.
Very, I also was a creative writing poetry major, so I was pouring my heart out into poems.
See, this is what I felt from you. That's what it
That's,
was. It
you
wasn't,
felt this little heartbroken
yeah,
kid.
Yeah, it wasn't the normal guy. I was like, this guy's got, it's got some heaviness. Seems sensitive. Yeah, that's what I felt. That
yeah,
felt
I'm a
like
sensitive
a,
guy.
We all
I'm not,
are.
But I'm not like a crybaby. I don't wear it.
I don't
my...
know that week.
I do cry.
I thought you might cry that week.
But I'm not a wimp. But I am sensitive.
Like, you know, who am I? I'm a pretty big pussy. But, but you know, we ended up working together. We traveled together. You opened for me. We were in Cleveland together. We had a nice conversation with the... Were you there for
oh,
that?
Oh, yeah.
Remember when we sat there? That was an amazing moment.
That was really cool.
Like, because you and I performed in the same theater complex that Dennis Miller and Bill O'Reilly did a show, like literally down the hall. And we were out front. I was smoking a cigar. You were smoking cigarettes. You still smoke?
Nope.
And that guy sat next to us, and he had gone to the O'Reilly thing, and I chose not to bring politics into it, and he just laid out his life for us. It was this interesting Southern life. He was a vet, right? He was in Vietnam, wasn't
he? Yeah,
he
was in Vietnam.
And like he just like, and it, we, you and I had that realization that if I'd brought politics into it, we would have not had that conversation.
Yeah, we would have been just pigeonholed the guys like, oh, that guy's an asshole.
Right, and it was just this beautiful kind of, it was moving in a way. And
it was superhuman.
Yeah, and he seemed to get emotional too about, you know, talking about this stuff. It was pretty wild. Cleveland's interesting.
It was cool, and it was like, it felt so symbolic. We're just sitting on a bench in the middle of the Rust Belt.
That's right.
Talking about America, not talking about politics, but
talking America.
Yeah.
All right, so... So you're in Berkeley. You're being a poet.
Yeah.
So you study poetry, creative writing?
I studied poetry and
did you publish some poems?
I had some stuff, and like I worked at the literary magazine. Like I was like an editor. Like
I did that.
Entertainment editor or some sort of editor.
Dude, this is what I'm telling you.
You saw. Yeah. See me and you.
Yeah, I mean, I was the editor of the Literary Journal. I wrote poetry. I was, you know, I was that guy. I killed that part of me.
Me too.
We didn't, though. We really didn't.
I tried. Yeah, I burned those moleskins, but I that part
did you?
Still. Yeah, I found some poems recently when I was looking through stuff, and whew,
taking it pretty seriously.
Pretty serious,
Yeah. I never understood that because I wanted to do poetry too, but you couldn't pick something with less of a future. You know, comedy has more of a future. Like, you know, it's like if you're going to be a poet, you probably got to stay in academia,
yeah,
and you got to publish poems that are only important to the other poets and a few people that read poetry still. It's so insulated and precious. I think it's important. I like reading good poetry occasionally.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the future is in it.
It was so, my parents they never were like, that's, you shouldn't do that. But I can't imagine them sacrificing.
You didn't feel the weight
everything.
Of it? Yeah.
No, I didn't really feel it. Because I was, you know, in academia. And
right.
I was really pursuing this.
And you graduated from Berkeley?
Yep, I graduated. It took me a while.
Yeah.
I didn't do it in 2 years. Like, I took some time off and went back and finished.
When did you start stand-up? Because I think stand-up's a reasonable extension of poetry.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did poetry slams. I would do, like, funny poetry slams. I know. And then I went through a big phase.
Did you ever go up against Jamie Kilstein?
No, I did not go up against Jamie Kilstein. I did go up against this guy, Bo Sia, who's a great, he's still like a good poet guy that I looked up to. But there was like a big scene in Oakland and Berkeley at the time, and that's another taste. I think I was always kind of skirting stand-up, but didn't do it. I was in bands. I did poetry.
Right.
I took an improv class in college, and while I was there, the director of the science theater at the, there's a public science center.
Uh-huh.
And, the director was like, hey, we have a children's theater. Would you like to be one of our improvisers? And so I got a job doing improv for little kids.
Oh, how was that?
About the brain. It was really cool because I was just like 20 or something, and all the other improvisers were like seasoned Bay Area improvisers and actors who had like a good day job with benefits. So
right.
They were all really talented, and I was like the new kid. That was,
who were they? Did you know any of them from television or anything?
No, but they were all like working professional actors that were like part of companies and stuff
right.
like that. And
yeah.
So I did improv about the brain and this troupe called the Brainiacs.
Uh-huh.
And we would, you know, do outreach at schools for an entire auditorium.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And I would present science shows and like dress up like a wizard and like do like science performances.
Look at you,
for kids.
Good Samaritan, good hearted guy.
Yeah.
Teaching the kids.
But then that was also stand up, like
right.
a 45 minute routine of me like, you know, putting an onion and some liquid nitrogen and like being like, what's going to happen, kids? And the kids are like, yeah. And like me rallying these kids and, you know.
So you got to do all the experiments and make smoke?
I did this. I made the smoke. I put the kids on the Van de Graaff generator where their hair would stick out and stuff. And it was like a 45 minute science comedy routine.
And then you have that nice relationship with kids.
Yeah.
It's
I love
fun.
Kids.
Yeah.
And so that was nice. And then eventually I was like, I have to do stand-up. Like, I just wanted to. And then I...
What was the slam audience like? Because a lot of those people do funny shit.
A lot of snapping.
Oh,
a lot
really?
Of that. A lot of head nodding.
But you got some good laughs, right?
Yeah, I got laughs. I just did... for that sort of thing, I didn't pour my heart out or do anything
right.
political.
You
I was just
deliver
being
the
stupid.
Goods. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just silly.
Yeah.
So that was fun. So I was like, oh, I love... I've just always liked being the class clown and center of attention, from debate to poetry slams to music to everything. And I was like, well, obviously.
Final Frontier.
Is stand-up like my childhood dream is the thing I really want to do. And
really? Was it?
Yeah, since I was a little kid.
Why? Who'd you watch?
Who Steve Martin was like it.
That was it?
That was it. Because I was just a little kid alone in a room. My parents were gone. And I would just watch like Wild and Crazy Guy and clips. Like I just had like a bunch of VHS tapes.
Yeah.
when I was a kid, I loved Gene Pompa. Like,
oh, he's great. I used to love Gene Pompa.
I was
a kid.
And I was
bear.
Like, yeah.
Hey there, little bear. Why the long face?
Like that joke, and like that joke about the her his boy his girlfriend's dad. And be like, your toothbrush tastes weird. And I was like, and I knew he was like a Latin guy.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this guy's like a weird Latin guy. Like, yeah. Not, I mean, he doesn't make a huge deal out of it. He does talk about it, but above all, he's a weirdo. And I was like, this guy is like my hero. And so I really
love. Does he know that?
When I first started comedy, I sent him a message on MySpace. And I was like, hey, I'm doing a show in LA. This is going to sound odd, but you're my comedy hero. Would you do the show? And he was like, really flattered.
Yeah.
And he ended up, he couldn't do it for some reason.
Yeah.
But I don't think I've actually ever come across him. Like, I've never
really
seen him since then.
I haven't seen him lately either, but I definitely liked watching him.
Oh, he's so cool.
And he had that weird thing he did with his mouth to kind of, like, I've only seen a couple of guys do it. It's like, you know, he'll deliver a line and he'll kind of half smile. You know, like he does this, like, almost like he's about to laugh at himself. Like, it's a charm thing.
Yeah. But he's like kind of shy. It's like he's embarrassed and he's about to laugh because he made a funny.
Right.
But he's not going to give it.
Right.
That.
But it's a device. You
it's
know,
a
that,
total device.
And I don't know I'm sure it just happened naturally.
Yeah.
But I've only seen a couple of guys do it. Rick Avilas used to do it, also Latino. Well, Rick Avilas was a street performer and then he became a stand-up. He was in Ghost. The movie Ghost. He was the scary guy, the murderer in Ghost.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, he passed away.
Oh.
And his brother's a stand-up too, but he was another guy who did that thing with his mouth. And I always remembered it because it was an interesting thing because it makes the audience want to laugh.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing. And I always liked watching Gene. And then he started wearing hats. I remember Gene before the hat, and then he wears the hat.
He's a hat guy now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know where he's at. He used to be an improv guy.
I think like he's still there. I see his name around. I just don't roll in the same
circles.
Oh,
you gotta go meet him.
I got to.
You gotta tell him that. I've never heard his name come up.
Yeah.
Especially someone's comedic hero. That's a very a flattering thing.
Yeah.
That he was the guy.
And there's another guy, Alvarez Guedes, who's like a straight up Cuban comedian that just had, he has like 40 records in Cuba. And my parents and I would listen to it all the time driving to my sister's house. Like, they would just listen to stand-up in the car, wherever whenever we drove somewhere.
Like, and in the delivery, what was it different? I mean, like, how does Cuban comedy work?
It was, like, jokes, like, set up punchline, one-liners. Some of them were, like, street jokes that he just used in his act.
Sure.
But his timing is, like, impeccable. Even if you don't, I listened to it recently. I was imagining what it would be like if I didn't understand it. And it seems like it would still be funny because just the intonation in his voice, and it's just so classy, and you could just, the timing of it is just like so perfectly performed.
It was like stand-up, so it wasn't broad, like character-driven stuff?
Oh, no. It was stand-up about life and life as being a Cuban. Like, he has this famous joke that I love that my dad would tell all the time. He's like, so Fidel just decided when they're going to bury his... he's made his funeral arrangements already in case he dies. They're going to bury his feet in wherever he's, like Matanzas, because that's where he took his first steps. They're going to bury his heart in Havana.
Yeah.
Because that's where he poured out his heart. And he just like went through his whole body and was like, and they're going to bury his ass all over the country because he shit all over the fucking thing. Like, he just had like jokes like that. You're like, whoa, that's like a heavy political, like it was like, you know, he delivered it way better, but the punchline was like, ooh, that's a good one.
So he didn't live in Cuba.
No, he left. And so he would do comedy in like Miami and New York and stuff that. But he had like over, I think 40 records.
Wow.
But my parents had them all.
Oh,
and
wow.
And we would just listen to him and like, it was super
as a family
live perform. It was like a live stand-up record,
and you do that as a family.
Yeah, we'd listen to it in the car as a family, and just like crack up. And my mom's very funny, and like it's like a funny.
Oh, that's sweet.
It's like a funny family.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So that you just like, I think maybe subconsciously, I was like, well, this is what I do when I'm a latchkey kid alone. And when I'm in front of the other kids at school, I'm starved for attention. I get laughs there. My family, when we're together on these car trips that are nice, we're listening to comedy. Comedy is just always there.
Well, how did you start stand-up? You started in San Francisco, like at the Punchline? Or
I started, I mean, that's the home club. That's where everyone goes every Sunday.
Right.
All the young comics.
To wait it out.
Wait a year for a spot.
I didn't know that until recently.
Yeah, everyone just, you got to sit in the back.
I talked to Ali Wong.
Oh, yeah. We started the same month.
Yeah. And I had no idea that was the system, because when I came to San Francisco, I was already kind of established, so I didn't have to come up through that. But I had no idea that you had to wait for a year, that Molly made you wait for a year.
Yeah. I think it's a good, I thought it was a good way to like.
You just watched.
You just watch and sit there every Sunday, and finally, like, you get the courage to talk to Molly, and as a young comic, it's very intimidating, and you're like.
She's intimidating as an old man.
Yeah, she's a badass.
Yeah.
And so I was like, hey, I've been, my name's Chris, I've been waiting for a year. She's like, okay, well, I've seen you around, so I'll let you know. And you're like, and then you just sit and wait.
But were you doing comedy other places?
Yeah, I would do all the mics and stuff. The Brainwash Cafe is where everyone starts.
Right.
And then, you know, it's a laundromat.
Yeah, I remember it. It sort of came to be when I was there, like in the early 90s, I think.
It's been around forever.
Yeah.
The guy, Tony Sparks, who runs it, he's like really passionate about it, really great to young comics.
Yeah.
And that's where you start. And then you do, at the time, there's a mock cafe, which is like this... it's like in the Mission, and there was like a bunch of luggage store, which was like some weird art space on Market Street.
Uh-huh.
Like it was all really kind of dingy places, but at the time it was like Moshe and Weinbach and Shang Wang and Louis Katz and all these people that I really
admired. What's Louis up to?
He just got a job writing for a show in New York, I think just last week. So he was here for a while and he just moved back to New York.
Okay.
I
always liked Louis. So, all right, so you come up through the ranks there, and that's when I met you, I guess.
Yeah.
Not that long ago. Five years ago?
About 5 years ago. It was just a couple of years in.
And then you have this amazing break in your career. Your dad gets Alzheimer's.
It was the best career decision I ever had, was convincing my dad to...
How is he?
Good, thanks for asking. He's hanging in there.
Yeah.
You know, he's safe, and he's in a home. And he's, you know, being taken care of and stuff. And it never really ever gets better, but it'll plateau for a while. And right now it's like he's just kind of calm and hanging out.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's you know, it's tough. But
yeah.
He's
here?
Yeah, he's here. He's in Long Beach.
Mm-hmm.
That's where his home is.
And do you go see him a lot?
Yeah, I go to see him on the weekends. Probably like every other weekend I go visit him and stuff.
With your mom?
Sometimes with my mom, sometimes not, but my mom's there all the time. She's there like 4 or 5 days a week.
Hard.
Yeah, but it's amazing, like, how dedicated she is to him and how sweet he still is to her. Like, he still carries her purse and stuff.
Oh,
like,
really?
He's, even though he doesn't always know it's her, he's like still.
Yeah,
The
habits are deep.
My mom's always says, like, you can tell which husband here was a bad guy, which guy was cheating. Like, she could always tell. She's like, that guy? Like, and she points him out. She's like, he tried to grab me. Like, she's always like very, she'll say stuff like that. But
about
like,
the other dementia people?
The other guys, like, she'll be like, that guy trying to grab my ass, that guy trying to grab my ass, this guy.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, she likes the attention. But
yeah,
like,
yeah.
She's like, dad is always very, like, he's like a good guy.
Polite.
You always tell, like, he's polite and sweet and stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's still hard, huh? Yeah, it must be hard. But it's nice everyone shows up, and I can't imagine what that's like, really, to watch the memories go. But
yeah, it's not, it's especially because my dad had such a vivid memory. He's an amazing storyteller. He could put you right in the place. He could talk about anything. Like, he was very well read. He'd talk about like Celtic folklore or something and just tell a story, and he'd like put you right there. He'd tell a story about when he's a kid, all these things, and that's just gone.
How do you frame it? Just that sometimes this happens as a natural course for life for some people, and you just kind of accept it, I guess, huh?
That what, Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah,
it's a terrible disease. It's like you know there's no solution to it. Unfortunately a lot of people get it.
Yeah.
And just people don't know how to fix it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, nope, it seems like people don't care about old people.
But you still enjoy the time with him.
Yeah, and now I feel like it's weird, but it's like a very calm time, and I just want to hang out with him,
right.
Even though he doesn't know who I am anymore.
Right.
Like, I just like, I'll try to dance with him or sing with him or like tickle, just to get any emotion out of him is kind of a beautiful thing. Because it's just in one little moment like that could just like make an entire 4-hour visit or
something.
Sure.
And a connection.
Yeah, it's a connection of any sort, you know. Like before I got married in October, and I went to talk to him before. Even he doesn't really. Sometimes he'll remember me, he'll like smile or something.
Yeah.
But I just went there, and because he couldn't come to the wedding.
Yeah.
And I just went, and I just talked to him. I was like, "Hey, Dad, I'm getting married. It's going to be awesome. Thanks for showing me how to be a good guy." Like all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I started bawling.
Yeah.
And he just like hugged me and patted my back and tried to force my mouth into a smile.
Yeah.
And it was just, and I put a smile on my face.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it was
yeah,
beautiful.
Yeah.
And like just any, a moment like that is just, it's very beautiful, and I'm lucky.
Yeah, where he could show up on an emotional level.
Yeah.
You know, that's deeper than the memory.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
And your wife, where did you meet her?
We met in San Francisco. We were coworkers, and we met.
Where?
We worked at Rooftop Comedy, where she was like a editor and producer, and then I was just like the homepage guy that I would like pick the clips and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And we met each other there.
So you're in comedy.
Yeah, in comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that
was when they had the big nationwide network of cameras.
Yeah, they had that.
They still do that?
I think they kind of changed. I think they're more into, I don't know, they've changed. I think they've rebranded themselves. And I think they're trying to produce shows.
Yeah, I think they're partnered with Audible or something.
Yeah, doing stuff. Yeah, with Audible and stuff.
I just learned that today.
Yeah.
Yesterday, yeah. So now, how's marriage going? Good?
Yeah, it's awesome.
Are you going to have a baby?
We're, in a couple years.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. We're going to enjoy
being... How old are you?
I'm 38.
Uh-huh.
And right now, we're just going to enjoy being married for a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna keep on making some traction in the comedy world.
Sure, man.
And then
well, you got the series. You know, you've done my live show. You did a live WTF, and you work with me on the road. You make an appearance in my special more later.
Yeah.
And Ira Glass heard you on my show, I imagine, and then put you on his show.
Yeah.
And got you a bigger audience.
Always swooping, you know.
I think he does sometimes. But that was a good venue for you, this American Life.
Yeah,
right?
it was a really nice and special. It's like the thing, I'm just so proud of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got you a lot of attention, I imagine.
I think, you know, some people noticed. It got attention for people like all over the world.
Whose
parents have dementia and
sure.
stuff like that.
Sure.
It got a lot of, like hundreds of messages from people that were really touched by it. And,
yeah.
It was nice not to feel so alone about it.
Uh-huh. And also to find the humor in it and be, to balance that humor with the emotions, I think probably provides people who are in the same situation with a lot of relief and the freedom to maybe look at it a little differently.
Yeah, I think so. That's kind of the point of it, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going out to do that, but I think that's what it does. It's
well,
what
yeah,
it does for me.
You, right. You've got to process it.
Yeah.
And in the way that you do it with your creativity and also to sort of balance the emotions of it.
Yeah. And so to make it funny and to find those moments balances it out.
Yeah.
It's and it's very
powerful shit, man.
Soothing.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. So this trip to Cuba was a honeymoon?
It was a honeymoon.
Prolonged honeymoon? Like you waited?
I waited a couple months to do it. It was my mom was not happy about it initially. She was they've never gone back to Cuba. I've never been to Cuba.
Have anger about it?
Yeah, they just don't want to go. They had a terrible time there. And
right.
Even though they have all their siblings and family there, they were just like, don't do it. But then I was like, you guys went on your honeymoon there. I want to go. Honeymoon where you guys honeymooned 50 years ago.
Good sales pitch.
And dad and I want to get the family history while I still can because dad can't give it to me.
Right.
So I'm going to go on this like pilgrimage and stay with our family there.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. So we went and we went to Havana and we stayed with my family for like half of the trip.
Really?
And I got to meet my whole family that I never met before.
Was traveling there easier because you went right at this time?
No, it's easy. Well, I can go straight there, and some people can, but we just flew from Miami to Havana.
Oh,
because
you're
no
a
problem.
Cuban citizen?
Because my parents are from Cuba, I could just travel there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
So it was easy.
Uh-huh. And who were you with, your aunt, your uncle, or who?
We stayed with my dad's sister And then we eventually met up with my mom's sister. But yeah, we met my dad's sister for the first time.
And they're all there, but your mom stays in touch, right?
Yeah, they stay in touch. It's like they send each other, they send them packages all the time. Uh-huh. They send medicine and money, and they write each other letters,
right,
and they
right.
talk on the phone. And right. that stuff like that's become easier over the years. At the beginning, they would like send packages that wouldn't arrive.
Right.
My dad would get heated on the phone and like yell about communism. The phone call would drop.
Oh, really?
Like stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
So, but now it's, you know, now that things are a little easier, they can, you know, call more and, you know, send letters.
Did you
freely.
Meet cousins that you didn't know about?
Yeah, I met every, I had most of my family's in Cuba and I met everybody. I met my.
For the first time.
For the first time. And it was so cool. My aunt is 70. She's so smart and so classy, and she's a lot like my dad, and uh-huh. I look just like my dad, so she just started bawling when she saw me because uh-huh. I'm the age that my dad was when he left, basically. And so it's like
hadn't
seeing
seen him in
she
person.
Hadn't seen him in person in, you know, since the 70s.
Wow.
And so she sees me, and it was like I cried every day for one reason or another, just of like sheer pride.
Yeah.
I heard all these stories from my aunt, like I told my aunt, I was like, Mom says that dad was the best dancer in the neighborhood. Like, she yeah. always talks about how good of a dancer yeah. dad was. And she was like, my aunt was like, no, he was a fucking weird dancer. He was like the weirdest dancer. And she started making fun of him. I was like, oh, my mom just had the hots for my dad.
You're right.
And then.
And maybe he was unique.
Yeah.
If he was a weird dancer,
yeah,
he stood out.
He stood out.
Yeah.
And then I met my cousins. They're all, you know, they're all really, I didn't know how poor my family, like my parents always guarded me from, I just didn't know how poor mm-hmm. my dad was.
Yeah.
And I got his whole story, and I was really blown away by how incredible of a journey that he's made from being like a street kid
oh,
to
really?
Like coming all the way. I learned, yeah, I just, my aunt, like I knew some of the story, but like my dad, I never heard my dad talk about his dad before. I didn't even
right.
know I didn't even know my grandpa's name
yeah.
at all.
Yeah.
And so I was like, what's your dad like? And she was like, and she showed me a picture, and he was like very dapper, and he was a swindler. He was like a con man, and apparently he was like kind of a party guy and loved the nightlife,
uh-huh.
and he would take my grandma out, and they'd go out and have a night on the town,
yeah.
and he didn't really care for his kids, didn't really care for my dad, so they would like, my grandma would give, or my grandpa would give my dad and his sister like Robitussin or like
to knock him out.
To knock him out.
Yeah.
And then one day, they knocked him out, and I think my grandma left the iron on and it like started a fire while they were out partying, and these two little kids woke up to like a fire in the house, and that's like one of their earliest memories
oh my
or experiences.
God.
Like
yeah.
this fire. And then he was just like, he was just like a, you know, womanizer. My dad's dad was a womanizer. And then
this is like pre-Castro.
This is pre-Castro. This is
when
Bautista.
It was big party town.
This is big party. American companies
yeah,
were
yeah,
coming.
Yeah.
Sherman Williams paint company came
yeah.
to the island. And my grandpa was like, okay, I see how these motherfuckers work. And he faked a workers' comp claim. Took him for a whole ton of money
uh-huh.
and then was like, peace out to my dad and
aunt
and grandma, and left Cuba, just abandoned them and went to Mexico, where he eventually started a baseball team. Like, he owned a baseball team. He was just like, he was like, fuck this, I'm out, and just left. And as a result, it left my you know, my dad and his family like on the streets.
Wow.
And they just couch surfed
uh-huh.
from their entire youth there. And that's how my dad eventually met my mom, is like he would like stay on their couch or like stay with their family and stuff. But like, my dad was very like, they were very poor
uh-huh.
and I didn't know like they just never had a home.
Wow.
And then my dad, there was this time at the time teenagers would in Havana would do this thing called alfabetizar, which means they would go to rural areas and they would tutor rural kids how to read.
Yeah.
They would like teach the kids
uh-huh.
on like plantations and stuff like that, just in the country, teach them how to read. And so my dad went and did that, and you know, they get paid, and my dad opted to send the money back to his mom so she could you know, get an apartment.
Right.
And so he also worked and made money at that time, and he sent it all home. And after like 3 months after he was gone, he came home and his mom had spent all the money.
Oh my God.
And so my dad was like, oh fuck. And so he got so mad that he just ran away.
Yeah.
And lived in a convent for a year.
Wow.
As like a teenager.
Uh-huh.
And then the nuns were like, they're like, you're a very bright young man. You're in a very terrible situation. And they got him to go to this fancy boarding school in the outskirts of Havana in Guanabacoa, which was like a really good school. And then he just went to school there.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he didn't have to worry about where to live and stuff.
Right.
And then he got out and he, you know, finished school. And his sister had a boyfriend or a husband at the time who made earrings. He was like an earring maker and a jeweler who was making a ton of money.
Yeah.
And my dad was like, huh, you're making a ton of money making hand making these earrings and stuff. And he saw that other people were making a bunch of money. And so my dad was like, I'll make an earring press. So he created an earring press that eventually a bunch of jewelers in town started using and buying from him. And my aunt said that, you know, her husband was balling. He was making like $80 a week. And my dad at that time was making $200 a week. Like he was rich.
Right.
For the first time.
Yeah.
And so he was like, he saved up. He did that for a while.
Yeah.
And then he was like, that's it. We're blowing this place. We're leaving Cuba. And he was just married to my mom.
Was Castro in by that
Castro
point?
Castro was in. This is the late 60s.
Right.
And my dad.
So everything changed.
Everything
and this jewelry press business had to be on the down low.
Had to be on the down. Everything's
right.
on the down low.
Right.
So it's illegal.
Right.
But he's still doing everything. There's a whole secret
right.
economy on the side in Cuba.
Right.
It's all, you know. So my dad's ballin', makes all this money. He goes to the government. He's like, hey, I'd like to leave. He presents his papers to leave Cuba. And they're like, no, you're a traitor. You're not a part of the Communist Party. You're like a Catholic. Fuck you. And so they take him and they send him to these sugarcane fields where he was in solitary confinement pulling sugarcane, like these sugarcane camps,
yeah,
where he pulled sugarcane, you know, sun up to sundown for 2 years.
Oh my God.
And like he was put in solitary confinement. Wow. And he was like tortured. He was given electroshock therapy. And like, I'm curious to see what resulted with other people at that time, because people like my mom suspects that my dad got Alzheimer's at an early age because of all the electroshock therapy
no
that he
kidding.
Was given and stuff like that. And so
your mom knew about all this?
Yeah, my mom knew about that stuff.
They
said like, oh, they sent dad away to this work camp
right.
for 2 years.
Right.
But he was, you know, he was away from his wife and his new daughter, and he was like, his hands are still scratched from pulling cane all day.
Wow.
He was like 100 pounds when he got out.
Yeah.
And then after 2 years, and that was a place where Catholics went, they sent homosexuals there. It was this
concentration camp.
It was like a concentration camp.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he was there, I mean, 67, like late.
Jesus
yeah, maybe
Christ.
67 to 69 or something like that. He was just in this. And he came out emaciated, and I didn't know when I was a teenager. I was like, Dad, you're crazy. Like, I didn't know that because of this, my dad had suffered, like, PTSD and stuff like
right,
that.
Right, right.
And so then he goes, you know, he does that for 2 years, and he's like, hey, I want to leave. He still wanted to leave Cuba, and they're like, sure, you can leave, but you got to leave your wife and your daughter behind. So my dad left and went to Spain. And he worked all over Spain. He worked on like tow trucks and engineering projects,
yeah.
construction, like all this type of stuff. And then made enough money to kind of bribe or like send my mom and sister to Spain. And then they lived there for a couple years.
And then they got it. And then they came here?
And then they came here.
Oh my God. So now after this trip, you go sit with your father and you are the container of this history.
Yeah. And it's so heavy. It's so... I just look at him and part of me is almost grateful that he can't remember some of this stuff because it's so bad. Even after he came to the United States, he had such a tough time because he was like, I'm in America. Well, let's do this. And then he was just like, you know, working
right
in a factory
yeah.
doing nothing. And he had a tough time. And he was like, he was put in an institution for like a couple months because he just had a breakdown because
really?
He was like, I can't fucking catch a break.
Wow.
Like, because he's his whole life, he just, he's just, you know?
Yeah.
I think about like the old man in the sea when I was right, I was there. There's, you know, the old man, they call him a salao. It's like the unluckiest of the unlucky.
Yeah.
And I think about that.
Wow.
But then I also think about how my mom is like the, like so valuable to him. Like she's so, so amazing and so beautiful and so funny and so kind. And it gives me a lot of hope because, just about love and humor. She's so funny to take this guy who's kind of at, you know, so kind of sad about things and just cheer him up, and him being nice and grateful to her. It's, you know, they've been married for over 50 years and they've gone through all that shit and they've known each other since they were like 15 years old.
And she's still there for him.
And she's still there for him. And he, as when he can, he's like there for her.
Is there a feeling that there's something peaceful about where he's at now sometimes?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Because he's like, yeah, he's mellow. Because, you know, he would blow up all the time.
Yeah.
Like, he would just, and now I get it, but I didn't get it at the time when I was in junior high and my dad, we moved to Westchester to this house and he was trying to put together a laundry, he was trying to make the laundry room and he fucked up and he destroyed the fucking thing with a hammer. He just took the whole thing down. Ugh. And I was like, why is my dad like this? And now I know. And I like regret that I like at the time, I probably don't know how I would have acted knowing this information. I was in high school, just being like a fucking teenage asshole. But like now it just, I have so much empathy and respect and admiration for him.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's glad that you get to own that and show up for him now.
You know,
there was probably nothing you could have done then necessarily.
Yeah.
Did you try to humor him? Is that where you sort of got... When he started knowing you were funny, was your relationship with him frightened, or were you did you try to humor the situation?
That was more my mom's thing. She was like, you know, they spoke their own language.
Right.
Not, you know, it had nothing to do with English or Spanish, but they just like, she would just like, just really charm him and like put a smile on his face. And that was their thing. I was more of like I know I talk about my dad the most, but I was like more of a mama's boy where she just like idolized me. And
I
was, you know, Latin mom
probably
stuff.
Protected you a little bit.
Protected me a lot from knowing all this stuff.
Yeah.
Because I was such a sensitive kid.
Yeah.
And such a crybaby. They're like, you can't handle this information. So we're just not going to tell you that. We're just going to pretend we're like all the other kids in your school.
Right. And
so,
also from his rage, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Or his volatility.
Yeah. And he never hit me or anything like
he was
that.
Just frustrated.
Yeah, he was just frustrated. I remember when I was a kid in high school, my dad asked me to make a resume for him because he was like, I just need a fucking job. Like he had trouble finding jobs. And so I made a resume on like bright blue paper. I didn't know how to fucking make a resume, but I like made a like probably some shitty font, like big font. I just tried to make it stand out.
Yeah.
And I went to fucking Kinko's to like print it out and I brought it back and my dad was like, what the fuck is this thing? And the way he thinks, he's just like, you did this so I wouldn't get a job.
Oh.
And then I took the resume, I wiped my butt with it and I threw it in his face. And the fact that I am alive to tell that story is like says something really nice about my dad. Like, he should have beat the shit out of me. He should have fucking pounded me into the ground. And he was just like, all right, cool. I guess I'll make my own fucking resume, you ungrateful piece of shit. But, you know,
that's a hell of an act.
I just really lucked out.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, my parents, you know, they went through a lot, but it was all for me, and I really appreciate it. And how great would it be if a kid with this life story ended up on Saturday Night Live?
Right. You hear that? So you go to Cuba, and you have this amazing experience, and you learn all these things about what you come from and the hardships your father went through in this very dramatic, painful story of transcendence. And then you go back and do the SNL audition.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh, man, this is a piece of cake. I mean, it's not, but I'm like, oh, this? I'm going to be scared of this? My dad was in a fucking sugarcane field.
Concentration camp
for 2 years, and I'm going to be scared of 12 white people with clipboards?
Right.
Oh, fuck out of here.
Right, so that would be, like, that explains the moment we talked about at the beginning, where you're at the reason why Jose Mati, like, it meant something to you.
Yeah, I was like, I really felt like it was like that Rocky moment, or like, I don't know, Superman, you know,
sure,
when he
man.
Leaves.
I am my
Krypton,
father's son.
And I'm like, yeah! Like, it really felt like a big Like yeah. almost like even like a Lion King moment.
Sure.
Just being
sure.
raised on the,
right.
the cliff or whatever.
And now they're making you wait as that moment dissipates.
Yeah, you think waiting in a green room for 2 hours.
My dad was gonna, in a sugar cane concentration camp. I'm not scared of you.
Been flying oh. me out to New York, putting me up. Oh, I'm so scared.
Yeah, really suffering.
Yeah. But
oh, man.
Whether I get it or not, it's just a privilege.
Yeah.
I mean, I just have a privileged life.
You do, man.
Yeah, I'm just a lucky guy.
Sure, and you know, and to have that framework now, given what your father went through, it's a real gift, buddy. And I'm glad you got a nice wife, and that you know you know I think that having all this information is only going to make you a deeper person in terms, like you know what I mean, to process that and to you know come out the other side with whatever childhood your memories you have, but then to sort of like see him in this whole other way is really a gift.
Yeah.
That's going to resolve things for you too.
I think so. It's very inspiring. It's given me a lot of hope.
Okay.
And it's given me an inspiration to be a better person.
Right on, man. Well, thank you for talking, Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
That was me and Chris Garcia. I like him very much. And now I want to go to Cuba. Now I'm going to be one of those guys, though, that's sort of like, I should have went to Cuba before it became regular. I could play. I'm not feeling very confident today, for whatever reason. But I'll play some guitar, because I know so many of you are just hanging out waiting for me to play my shitty guitar. Boomer lives!